Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Jacob Goldstein, author of Money, The True Story of a Made-Up Thing, published by Hachette in September. So Jacob is an NPR correspondent, co-host of Planet Money, a really great podcast, and a cool episode of This American Life. He's worked for The Wall Street Journal, The New York Times Magazine. So money, what the hell is it? Do I have enough? Do I have too much? Where is my money? My bank says I have some numbers. The stimulus bills give away trillions and trillions of dollars when the Democrats were arguing about billion-dollar programs. But it turns out, Jacob tells us, money is nothing. It's fiction. It's a made-up thing. Except you have to have it or you can't eat, you can't shop, you can't get gas. So let's see what it really is and isn't by talking to Jacob. Hey, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I wasn't sure where we could begin because we're going to go all over the place. But so let's start with talking about a Swedish $10 coin, which is 2 feet long and weighs 43 pounds. And we can go from there.
Yeah, that's a great place to start. So it was made of copper. It was used in the 1600s, as you said, in Sweden. And this was, of course, you know, the era when the value of a coin was based on the value of the metal it contains, right? So we're used to thinking about gold and silver coins, which were quite standard in Western Europe at the time. But in Sweden, they had a lot of copper, so they used copper. The problem was copper wasn't worth that much. So to make the coin worth a lot, they had to make it really big. So they made this coin that was like a few feet long, you know, weighed, as you said, like more than 30 pounds. People would carry it strapped to their backs. And so not coincidentally, it came to pass that in Sweden in the 1600s, they started this bank that would take in your copper coins and exchange, give you a piece of paper that was like a claim check for a copper coin. And that paper was the first paper money in Europe.
And then, going, and I'll jump all over the place because I just can't do that. But if we go back to where you really kind of start, it's back in China. China starts out great and then it kind of gets lost. But it's the first era, it's the first place in the world where paper money is used.
Exactly right.
Yeah. And so you could describe how that came about, and that leads us into the next stage.
Yeah. So the story of China and the kind of origins of paper money is really interesting and a kind of a beautiful narrative arc. And the beginnings are similar to what would happen hundreds of years later in Sweden. In this instance, it was a province in China, Sichuan, where they used iron for coins. And the same kind of problem as Sweden. Iron wasn't very valuable, so you needed a lot of coins, you know, thousands of coins. And so it happened with a merchant, not a bank there. A merchant took people's iron coins and gave them a paper receipt, and the receipt started to circulate as money. And then people loved it in China, right? It was this technological breakthrough, a much easier way to transport, you know, value, purchasing power. The government essentially got involved, took over making paper money, spread around the whole country. And it became part of this much larger, really incredible economic boom that happened in China after the year 1000 AD under the Song Dynasty, where they had technological innovations and agricultural innovations, and paper money itself was an innovation, and the flourishing of great cities and like a restaurant scene emerging. Really this incredible urban market-driven world. The Mongols invade at some point, as they are wont to do, and the Mongols love paper money. You know, they are this nomadic civilization. They have an empire that spans Asia, right? So if you're going back and forth across Asia on a horse, paper is way better to carry than bronze. They for a while actually have basically what we would call today fiat money. At one point, Kublai Khan, grandson of Genghis, says, you know what, paper money, it's just going to be paper. And it works. And then there's another revolution. The Ming Dynasty pushes out the Mongols. And the Ming Dynasty is sort of fundamentally reactionary. Like, they don't like all this new fangled paper money and markets and restaurants and cities. They like the countryside, the like noble peasant, the self-sufficient village. And so they actually wind up abandoning paper money altogether. And going back to metal, paper money disappears really from the world for a few hundred years. And China, which has been getting richer, starts to get poorer. China becomes worse off for quite a long time after that.
Well, it's interesting. Well, we could go to John Law first, but before we do that, and because the title is what the title is, talk about money in terms of it, as I said in the introduction, actually being a fiction, because I would like to know whether it's a psychological something that we just accept, or whether it's a kind of mass hypnosis. How would you describe it in the fact that your title says it's a made up thing? So it's like kids playing makeup, playing imaginary friends.
You could call it that. I mean, what I mean by made up thing is this. It feels like, it felt to me before I started, you know, covering money. I was an English major. I never really paid attention to money until I was well into my adult life. And so I always, that's kind of a trade-off. I'm not sure I feel about that, but it's fine. It's working out fine. You know, I never really thought about money that much, but to the extent that I did, it seemed like this thing that was not quite, but like sort of subject to the laws of physics. You know what I mean? Like this thing that sort of exists in the world the way light exists and water exists and whatever. And like the big point that I try and make in the book is that is not true at all, right? Money is a thing that people invented. And in fact, didn't just invent once, again and again and again, in quite different ways with quite different rules over time. And that will likely continue to happen in the future. So, you know, what I mean to say is money doesn't exist in the world without people. It's a thing that people made up. And it's the product of a set of choices we make in a very social way, right? The whole reason it works is because we're all agreeing on the rules, basically. And that, so, you know, we have some control over how money works. It's whatever we want it to be.
Well, then let's move on to John Law, because he creates this kind of parabolic curve in your book and drives it to a certain extent, at least the beginning of it.
Yeah, John Law is a really extraordinary figure, and he comes along at this very interesting formative moment in the history of money, and frankly, in history in general, in Western Europe. He's born in the 1600s in Scotland, and, you know, sort of by the way, grows up and becomes like a man about town in London and kills somebody in a duel and is sentenced to death for, you know, committing murder, and then he escapes from prison and goes on the lam to Europe. And this world he is going on the lam in is really the world where we see the beginnings of kind of the modern economy, the beginnings of financial capitalism. There's, you know, he goes at one point to Amsterdam, and Amsterdam is the city where really the first modern multinational corporation with freely traded stock is. It's the Dutch East India Company. And there's a stock market in Amsterdam, and there's a city bank in Amsterdam. And he sees that Amsterdam is getting rich, not because it's like a particularly, you know, rich landscape or well situated, but because they're doing money right. He sees in London the Bank of England, which is sort of the first central bank and this interesting institution that makes it easier for the government to borrow money. He sees the emergence of paper money. It's been happening in Sweden, as we said. It's also happening in England with goldsmiths giving people paper receipts. And so Law sees all of these different things, and he says, oh, by the way, he also gets rich as a gambler. I didn't even say that. They just invented probability theory. He figures out probability theory, gets rich as a gambler. So he sees all of these different pieces of you know, finance essentially existing in Amsterdam and in England, and he thinks, I'm going to put them all together and make some country great, to coin a phrase. And so he tries going home to Scotland and pitches his ideas in Scotland, and they're not interested. And he kind of goes around Europe, and I don't know, maybe the Duke of Turin he pitches. I think he's in Vienna. Anyway, he finally finds a taker in France where the king is a little boy. It's one of the Louis. I lose count. Maybe 14. I don't remember which Louis. And France is being run by a regent, the Duke of Orléans. And the regent, like John Law, likes gambling and drinking and is also, you know, very smart. John Law is very smart. And so Law pitches this big idea to the regent. The regent takes him up on it. And so Law very quickly sets up France's first modern bank, France's first paper money, which is printed by this bank, Law gets control of this trading company, kind of like the Dutch East India Company, that is France's North American holdings, right? This was before the Louisiana Purchase, so France controls the whole center of North America along the Mississippi River, and names the capital of this territory after his, you know, his benefactor, the regent, calls it New Orleans. And then sell stock in this company, which, of course, you can buy with the paper laws bank. And there is this incredible boom in the stock market. The stock price goes up and up, and people are flooding into Paris to trade the stock and getting rich. John Law becomes like the richest guy, more or less, in the world, if you don't count kings and queens. They invent the word millionaire because people are getting so rich, they need a new word to describe it. And then, of course, it all comes crashing down, and John Law gets, you know, chased out of town and moves to Venice and gambles and collects art until he dies.
It was interesting to me how I hadn't really thought about it, how a country that has no natural resources at all can have a great currency, and then a country, I think it was Scotland, that has all these natural resources but can't handle money well, suffers.
Yeah, yeah. There's this great tract, basically, that Law writes. After he goes back to Scotland with his big plan, he actually makes exactly this argument that you're describing. He says, like, look, there are all these reasons that the Netherlands should be a crappy country. It's like, it's a bad place. They got Germany right next to them. I mean, it wasn't Germany yet, but whatever, the Germanic states, blah, blah, blah. But they're rich because they're doing money right. They've got their act together in terms of money. And then he says, look at Scotland. Like, we got great land. We're in a perfect spot, but we're poor because we are doing money wrong. Like, we got to get money right in order to not be poor anymore. And, you know, it's interesting because the sort of standard picture of Law, the kind of conventional wisdom about John Law in history, is like he was a con man. He was like, you know, classic shady finance guy who rode into town with this big dream and got rich and like broke France, basically. But I think that is unfair. You know, his writings about economics are quite smart, and he basically understood where the world was going. I think things just got out of hand in France. And, you know, he did have too much power. One way to think about it is France was this absolute monarchy. And so once the region said to Law, more or less, do whatever you want, Law kind of was able to get carried away. And you can compare it to England, which did have its own problem at the same time. The South Sea bubble was about the same time as this Mississippi bubble associated with John Law. But England did better, and I think in part because they had some amount of what we would call checks and balances, not to the extent we do here, but Parliament had significant power relative to the king, and they'd created the Bank of England, which was this interesting kind of intermediate institution that would loan money to the king, but had more authority to get paid back by the king than a lot of other institutions in other countries where the king could just say, no, sorry, I'm not going to pay you back. And so I think this idea of having sort of multiple centers of power where, you know, the banks have some power and there is a rule of law, so the courts have power, and there's, you know, maybe Congress or a government, I think that's really helpful in constraining finance. Obviously not entirely effective. We still have financial crises, but I think it gives us a better shot than in a country where one institution or person has all the power.
It's interesting because I thought about this book, having just read it. You know, the economy is horrible. Theoretically today, people are dying every day. People have lost their jobs. And yet yesterday, because of the vaccine, the Dow goes up in the morning 1,600 points, trillions and trillions of dollars. And likewise, in March, on March 18th, if you had put all your money in stocks like Wayfair or Tesla or RV stocks, you would have five or six times your money. If I, the first time I saw a Tesla, if I had bought it at four, $100,000 worth, I'd have $10 million today.
Did you?
No.
Oh, I guess we wouldn't be here if you did.
I would be somewhere. No, you can't be anywhere either. That's true. No, it's funny. The girl I was in the car with, when she saw the car, I was coming back from New York, and she saw the Tesla, and she goes, oh, wow, look at the Tesla. And she goes, they're great cars. And I thought to myself, oh, well. And so I texted her yesterday. I said, you know what would happen? She goes, if I had listened to your advice. And she goes, I wish I had listened to my advice. So, yes. Yeah, but that, what is that? What is that? I mean, where is that? What, trillions and trillions of dollars. And just like I said, the introduction, stimulus bill, $3 trillion, and maybe another $3 trillion. Yet at the same time, I remember the debates when they're saying this will cost $100 billion over 10 years. Well, what happened to the foolishry of that, you know?
Yes. There's a lot there. So, one of the things that's noteworthy about the stock market is this recession that we've been going through has been really striking for how differently it has impacted different people, right? And right. It's basically been much worse for poor people than for rich people. And the stock market is disproportionately owned by rich people who can put more money into the stock market, right? So, I mean, in very straightforward terms, the stock market is sort of a rich people economy, and rich people are doing okay. And poor people are doing much worse. I mean, low-income jobs tend to be the, you know, service industry jobs tend to be the kind of jobs that have been hit much harder by the pandemic. Higher-income jobs are jobs that people can do more at home. They're jobs that are in fields that have been hit less hard by the pandemic. So, I mean, that's a simple version of what's happening in the stock market.
Yeah, well, as they say, stock market is not the economy.
Right.
But it's true, though, you know, with three buttons, you can make more money in 5 minutes sitting in your chair than a janitor or someone at Starbucks will make in their entire life.
Yes, or lose more.
True. True. One of the things I haven't heard in your interviews, or maybe I missed it, is no one's ever talked about you haven't talked about the tulip bubble in your interviews. And that's a good example of what's going on now and whether value really is value or if it's just a psychological construct.
Yeah, I mean, the tulip bubble is not in the book, but it's similar to other bubbles, right? I mean, the Mississippi bubble of John Law's stock was one. Frankly, it's not obvious to me that there's a bubble in stocks right now. You know, going up is not the same thing as a bubble. It's much easier to call something a bubble after it goes down, right? But, you know, it is the case that prices move a lot. They move more than fundamentals would suggest they should, right? And, you know, there is this idea of what Keynes called animal spirits, right, that move people to act in one way or another, both with a kind of, you know, irrational exuberance, to quote another economist, but also a kind of irrational fear at other times. And so, you know, I don't know. Don't check your 401k every day.
Yeah, well, that's my brother. You know, he put stuff in Vanguard 20 years ago, and he hasn't looked at it since.
Yeah. Unless it's fun, but it's not good. It's not good financially, but if it's like a hobby, okay, yeah.
Well, it's like what you were saying, whether it's tulips, which makes no sense to me, or what you say about gold is, and you can't eat it. Basically, you can't eat it. What is the inherent value of it? It's just because we all believe that
yes,
it's valuable.
Yes. No, I mean, people, you know, it is the case that money today is nothing, right? I mean, you could say it's a piece of paper. For the most part, it's just money in a bank account, which isn't even a thing, right? It's just a number on a bank's computer. And so I think there is this, I don't know if instinctive is quite the right word, maybe nostalgic desire among some people to have gold as money because it's a thing, because it is naturally finite. That has an appeal to some people. But there is not much inherent value to gold. I mean, it's used a little bit in electronics, but most of its value comes from this strange persistence, right? It comes from the fact that for thousands of years, people have ascribed value to it, and there's an assumption that that will persist. But that's just an assumption. There's no natural value. I mean, you can look at stocks and say, well, the company has been making this amount of profits for the last several years. I can have some basically rational assumption about what their profits are going to do over the next several years. And what you're really buying when you buy a stock is a claim to their future profits. So you can build some model that will give you some number. And it might be right or wrong, but at least there's some rational basis for having the stock be worth one amount of money or another. And with gold, that's not even there.
It's funny. I always remember, I think it was in Cannery Row by John Steinbeck, where there was a jukebox and Doc puts a nickel in the jukebox. And what the nickel does is it completes the circuit to allow the song to play. And he said that was the only time he ever saw money actually accomplish anything.
That's really elegant. I really like that. Yeah. It's like, make it a little. I remember at camp, at summer camp, people would take a nickel and like pound it a certain way and it would become a ring. It doesn't seem true as I say it, but like, as I recall, there would be like you would pound it and you could get a hole in the middle and you could wear a nickel as a ring. Is that true? I remember it, but when I say it, it doesn't sound true.
Where'd you go to camp?
I went to camp in the mountains in Southern California. Why camp?
Yeah, I went to camp in the Poconos here in Pennsylvania. What I used to do was my brother and I would put a penny and then a dime on top of it on the railroad tracks. You'd take a little piece of gum so the vibrating rail didn't knock it off. And then when it went over and you'd have this beautiful guitar pick kind of thing with the dime embedded into the copper.
Oh, that's really nice. I've heard of people doing just the penny, but I feel like the dime plus penny, you're really taking it to another level there.
Yeah. I guess there is a certain aesthetic to money as well, and some of the current. That's interesting also, just like stock certificates. I never
Yeah. You know, there's a fun story about the euro where, you know, so this was a bunch of countries in Europe deciding to give up their own currencies and share a currency. And so there arose the question, okay, but what do we put on this money, right? Who is it? One country gets to put their bridges, another country. And so they decide they're just going to do like abstract bridges. So that way nobody has to fight over who gets their bridge on the money. And they do that. But then some guy in England isn't even using the euro, right? England is just like mocking the euro at this point, figures out that they're actual historical bridges and kind of trolls the Europeans by saying, hey, I got you. You couldn't even put fake bridges on your money. There's actual real bridges. I think they changed it after that.
And the other ones I like are the loony and the toonie. But the problem is, if you go to Canada, you end up at the end of the day with just like with the carrying around bronze or copper, end up with this pocket full of really heavy coins.
Right. You wish somebody would give you a paper receipt in exchange for your one Canadian dollar coins, but they got rid of it. Right?
That's true. And I owe you. But yeah, it's because, and that reason makes sense too. It's because the dollar lasts 18 months and then it wears out, whereas a coin pretty much lasts forever.
Right.
So there's a kind of value laden thing.
Yes. Well, and governments make a profit off of printing money, right? Because they are basically can sell a piece of paper for $100, right? So that's a good business to be in.
Except pennies began costing more than a penny to make.
Pennies are negative. I think nickels also cost more they cost more to make than 5 cents.
Yeah, which is why
killing the penny seems like an easy call. I mean, I might get angry letters from the zinc industry. Pennies are mostly zinc, but yeah, no, there's no reason to have pennies.
Well, I have an independent bookstore and I hate pennies. And I keep trying to tell my staff, just round it up, round it down.
Round it down. Great. Yeah. I'll give you 3 cents.
Yes. If I lose my store because of that, then I should be running a store.
Yeah. The margins are tight, but not that tight.
Take a penny, leave a penny. Sure. You know, I'm sick and tired of all that crap.
Yeah.
Get rid of them. So what I like to do is I like to give out $2 bills, and I like to give $2 bills because there's no slot in the cash register to put a $2 bill. It's very irritating that's just the kind of person I am.
But also I could imagine like if people enjoy getting the $2 bill, then they like think fondly of your shop, or it's like a little memento in a way.
Kids love getting $2 bills and they love getting the Sacagaweas too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a good one.
I love, like, some with my nephews, I would give them, like, on their bar mitzvah or whatever, a wooden box filled with 100 Sacagaweas. And
oh, that's nice.
Wouldn't that be?
You know, you can do old silver dollars are fun too. You know, you can get an old silver dollar for maybe a little more now, but you know, probably now $30 or something.
Right.
And it's fun. It's, you know, it's 100-year-old coin. I don't know if you can get a 100-year-old silver dollar, but for not that much money, you can get this cool old coin.
Right, the Walking Liberty ones. Yeah. And then the other thing that's really interesting is like Krugerrands. Krugerrands are just 1 ounce of gold, but depending on the year, they're worth more. It's like a vintage of a wine.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you think of just a piece of paper and some stamp is worth $1 million, like.
There you go, currency of baseball cards.
Yeah, sure.
It all
cigarettes. There was a famous paper that an economist who was taken prisoner in World War II, wrote about how cigarettes became a money in the POW camp, and how this complex economy emerged, and people would, it was kind of like a lending market about when the food rations would come in. There were middlemen who would like buy the food and sell the food and try and time it with when rations came in. It's a great little paper.
Yeah, it still is a currency in prison. You know, talking about my bookstore reminded me about the cover of your book, because as I always say, everyone says you can't judge a book by its cover, but every single person who comes into my bookstore judges every book by its cover.
So how's my book doing?
Well, I think the cover is really good, and it's sitting on the front table, and everyone's interested in money.
Okay, so, I'm glad to hear it.
I mean, and it's green, and it shows kind of what it goes for, because I could only print it out at this point. But yeah, so did you get a chance to vet the cover, or did you pick it, or how'd that work?
I mean, the timeline was not my idea. You know, my one request was, please don't have some Renaissance painting of a banker or an old coin on the cover, because that's what like every money book has. And, you know, one of the things I was trying in this book was to make it feel more contemporary and like have a more of a chatty tone and not feel like some heavy, dusty old history book. And so all the credit for the cover design goes to Hachette, goes to the people at the imprint. But I'm very happy with the way it came out.
Yeah, it's interesting that, I always ask authors that, and generally they have nothing to do with the cover because the publisher knows what sells. They know what the picture on the, you know, it doesn't make any difference what your book is actually about. It's just someone buying it. Speaking of which, I always end up getting away from the book, and we are trying to sell your book. So let's go back to it.
Sure.
And talk a little bit about a couple of things that now we accept, but the concept of a loan, the concept of a short, those two things, which are very, very important in our world today.
Yeah, there's this phrase that I quote from a contemporary writer about finance who I really like named Matt Levine. He says, the essence of finance is time travel, which is just this lovely, delightful idea. And all he means by that is, the most basic thing finance does is move people's ability to spend money around in time. So simply, if I right now have extra money, money that I want to spend later, what a bank does in the most basic form is pair me up with somebody right now who needs money. Somebody who, you know, maybe they just got a job, but they need to buy a car so that they can go to their job and get money. And if they can't get a loan now, they're screwed. They can't get their job and get money. So the bank takes my money that I want to spend later and gives it to somebody who needs money now, right now. And then that person pays back the bank, and I can get my money later with interest from the bank. And so that's the most kind of basic finance there is. And it's a really elegant solution that, you know, matches up people who want to spend money now versus but don't have it, and people who want to spend money later and have money now.
Yeah, and if somebody is interested in getting into the stock market and just buys and sells or does limits or stops, a good way for them to get the concept of futures under their belt is to think of what you write about with the East India Company, you know, whether or not this ship's going to sink or make it back, and I'll either bet for it or against it, and then there's an arbitrage.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, maybe not surprisingly, the first short, the first sort of bet against a stock came about almost as soon as there were stocks as we know them, right? So the Dutch East India Company was the first sort of widely traded stock in the way that we think of stocks now. And there was a guy who had been associated with the company but then had gotten forced out. And he has this whole scheme where he gets his sort of co-conspirators, not to load the dice against him, whatever, a group of people to bet that the price of the Dutch East India Company stock is going to fall. And the company doesn't like that this is going on. They find out that this is happening, and they basically make new rules that make it very hard to bet that the price of the Dutch East India Company stock is going to fall, right? And this is familiar today. You know, when a company's stock today is falling, or sometimes even when it isn't, you'll see the CEO, you know, go on CNBC, go on financial news and complain about the shorts, complain like, oh, our problem is people are betting against our stock and spreading rumors and making it fall. But I am fundamentally pro short, right? Like, everybody thinks, oh, it's always good when the stock market goes up. But the point of the stock market is not to go up, right? The point of the stock market is to try and, well, it's to let people invest in companies. But you want stock prices to be possible, the best possible reflection of the value of the company, right? And obviously, it doesn't always work and prices go haywire. But sometimes a stock price is too high and you want people to have a financial incentive to investigate companies, to go, you know, you can short a stock and then you have an incentive to find out if the company is committing fraud, if the company is shady. You have a financial incentive to go out into the world and tell everybody, hey, this company is a shady company. Like, that's good. That's information that we all want in the world. So it is useful to have the ability to short stocks.
Yeah, it's interesting. Elon Musk does a lot of things. He's a jackass. He can land boosters and catch fairings, which, geez. And
I don't even know what that means. What's a fairing?
Fairing is it's the top of the nose cone that splits apart so the satellite can come out.
Oh, right. Okay.
And then he has that ship, Mrs. Stevens, that catches it in nets. And then his batteries and then the Teslas. We go back to the Tesla. The funny thing about Elon Musk is he turns this economy topsy-turvy because he tells everyone, my stock is overpriced.
Yes.
Then he laughs at the people who short it. And it confuses everybody, and it's just the kind of person he is.
And the SEC doesn't like it, right? The SEC has tried to, because, like, if you're running a public company, you're not supposed to say a lot of the things that he says.
Or smoke pot on your podcast.
I don't even know. Does the SEC care about that anymore? That
I don't know, but they can't stop SpaceX because it's delivering astronauts that we've never been able to do.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's a very interesting thing. It's funny. My father always said, and I think this is true, he says, you can do whatever you want with your life, but money can't be the most important thing. It can slap up right below what's the most important thing, but it can't be the most important thing. And he says, if you do that, then the money will come. And I think that's Steve Jobs, Elon Musk, Edison, Tesla again, all those people. That's why they succeeded when they succeeded.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I mean, it's interesting to think about it in different contexts, right? Even when you think about rich people, like, in a way with rich people, it's more perplexing because it's like, you're already super rich. Like, another $1 million isn't going to change your life. You can already buy everything, right? So clearly, in many ways, it's not about the money.
Well, that's an interesting concept too, is suppose you have a lot of money, 10 million, 100 million, whatever, but you don't want to buy a Lamborghini because you don't want to park catty corner at the corner of a parking lot, and you don't want to cry when you get your first dent, and you don't like jewelry, and you don't want to buy a boat. You want to have a friend who has a boat so they can take care of it. You don't want to buy a jet. If you're like me, you buy books, you know, first editions. Why are they valuable? Because it's a mutual psychosis. Or you buy, I don't know what you buy, but if you don't want to buy anything and you just have in your Fidelity account numbers that sometimes you put numbers into the Wells Fargo account and the numbers just moving back and forth, then what is that?
You know, there's this guy who I admired from a distance who became very rich building up duty-free shops in airports. And then essentially secretly gave away this massive fortune where he didn't even control the giving himself. He sort of created this board where he had one vote. And it only came out because of some, I don't know, there was some like esoteric tax thing that happened or something, and it became public. But like not just the menchiness of giving away the money, but like not even wanting your name on it seems like profoundly admirable.
It reminds me of the Curb Your Enthusiasm episode where...
Danson.
Yeah. I'm anonymous.
Yes. No, it's perfect. Right. So Ted Danson is giving away this money anonymously, but then he makes sure everybody knows that he's giving it away anonymously. Right. At the double dealing of that. Exactly.
My brother and I can't watch more than one episode in a row because we get agita because that we remind them of Larry David. And so it's very difficult. You know, part of it is the concept if you tell a little lie and then you have to tell a bigger lie to cover up the...
Yes, those are those those are my less preferred episodes. You know, I like the episodes that are just more in the sort of pure absurdity, as opposed to the ones I feel more pain in, the trapped in a lie episodes, where you know, like, the person he saw in act one is going to come and be present in act three in a very uncomfortable way. I don't like those episodes so much.
Yeah, it's like the play where if you see a gun in the first act, yes, it has to go off in the...
Yes, and Curb Your Enthusiasm, if you see a lie in the first act, it will go off in the third.
As long as it has either Leon or Michael J. Fox, I'm happy, you know?
Yes, Leon is amazing.
He is. And then when you listen to him talk, he pretty much talks the same way.
Uh-huh. Well, I think that's the whole thing in that show, right? Same is true for Larry David.
Yeah, well, there's no scripts and you just say what you want to say. Once again, when we have, this will not sell one of your books.
Maybe it will. Maybe there's one person listening who loves Curb Your Enthusiasm and it was like, okay, he likes Curb Your Enthusiasm. I'm in. I'm going to buy Money, the True Story of a Made-Up Thing.
Well, yeah. And Larry David is that in his real life and in the show, he's that kind of person I was discussing. He has billions of dollars. He has at least $1 billion, but it really doesn't come into play unless it's part of the humor.
His house looks nice in the show. I bet he has a nice house in real life.
Who knows? Yeah. But it's like when he's opening up the Spite shop. I don't have my coffee cup that says...
Latte Larry's. Yeah, I like that. I like that arc.
And then all the other stars who also have Spite shops. And
yes, yes.
Including Sean Penn. All right, I got to stop. Okay, so what else haven't we talked about? We talked about Mongols and shorts and loans and even the tulip bubble and the stock market and Amsterdam. And John Law, what else? Oh, here, I'll ask this for my last question.
Okay.
So cryptocurrencies, what are they?
Not a question. So, sorry.
You sound like, what's his face from Facebook? Was that a question?
That's not what I was going for.
Well, okay, so cryptocurrencies are even more esoteric than the concept of money, because they really don't exist. It actually is a group of people who say, we are going to create this thing that doesn't exist. And we're only creating a finite number of them so that we can, the value will go up or down floating with the coins. So how does that change anything, or is it just the same thing, only a different color?
Well, so, I mean, you know, Bitcoin, you know, the dollar also doesn't exist, right? Like, to be clear, the dollar is made up. Now, it is the case that the dollar is backed by the United States of America, which is also in its way, right, a fiction. There is some land here, but the idea of a country and law, like, these things are things that people made up, right, and that we all kind of live with because it's useful. So the biggest difference about Bitcoin is the dream, at least, of Bitcoin from the people who made it, is that you could have money without a government. Right. There are interesting technological details, but the fundamental, I think, thing about it is the possibility of having money free of a government. And it really hasn't happened yet, in the sense that people don't really use Bitcoin to buy stuff. Right. It clearly is valuable for reasons that are, I think, still a little bit mysterious. Maybe people think it will be money in the future. Maybe people think it's sort of like gold, a thing that is just going to be valuable because it's valuable. And it would be a huge shift if it took off, I think mainly because of the non-governmental nature of it. But I think for that same reason, governments would fight hard against Bitcoin taking off, because governments like to control money and don't want it to be just out there in the universe.
Well, in an alternate universe, then, if there were not money, what would any or some alternatives be that would allow civilization to continue and to thrive?
So, I mean, basically, you would have two choices. One, you couldn't have, one would be not civilization as we know it. It would be much more like small group communities, a very sort of tribal existence, where you have small groups of people who are self-sufficient and kind of get along with, you know, kind of norms of reciprocity, basically, right? You're sharing, you're giving, you're trading. I mean, and that has a nice kind of warm, fuzzy vibe to it, but it's not going to happen in the modern world, right? You, in material terms, you would be very poor because you would be making everything yourself. It would be super inefficient. So, like, realistically, that's not going to happen. That's kind of one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum you could imagine is something very top-down, an incredibly autocratic society where the government basically takes everything everybody makes and decides who gets what, right? That's another way you could live without money, would be for essentially the government, a central authority, to take everything and then redistribute it as it saw fit. And so one option, basically neither of those is really going to work as far as I'm concerned. Like the sort of hippie dream, like that's not going to happen. The autocracy sounds like a total dystopia. So I feel like we're basically stuck with money.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, as you were speaking of socialism and, you know, Lenin and the concept that everybody gets what they need to live, but people aren't, that never happens because power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And it turns into something that it wasn't meant to be. Any utopia does.
And yeah, so, I mean, you can have some amount of redistribution in a monetary society as we have. And you can argue about, you know, sort of what the right margin is. And maybe you need some more redistribution, but you're still going to have money. I mean, the notion that, you know, people are going to give up control over the most basic decisions of their daily life is implausible.
I know, that's why it's so funny when you talk to, say, a Tea Party person or a Trump person. They don't want government intervention, but you say, if you say to them, I'm taking your Social Security away or your Medicare or your Medicaid, they would go berserk. And Social Security is by its very nature and name, pure socialism. Yes, you put money in, but you're getting a different amount out. Yeah.
There's a lot there that I'm just going to let that all sit.
I know. I'm just going off.
Yeah.
But anyway, so to conclude, the book is excellent. And the thing about it is, and again, as a bookseller, the reason why I think it will be so successful, or already is because the title, the subtitle, The True Story of a Made-Up Thing, makes you stop. It, you know, if you're walking through the bookstore, you stop and you turn around because, yeah, it's so counterintuitive. When you pass by, it doesn't seem right. The title doesn't seem right. And I think that's what's so cool about the book.
Great. I'm delighted that you like the title. I like it too. And I had fun writing the book and I tried to make it fun to read. So I really hope people enjoy it.
Yeah, and I had fun talking to you. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you so much for having me on. Thanks for your time and thanks for putting my book on the table in your store. I really do appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. Okay. Take care. Bye-bye.